Our fifth case for argument this morning is United States against Burton. Ms. Christensen.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, Daniel Burton, in this case. This case presents two issues which seem to be unique to Mr. Burton's situation and the district court proceedings in this matter. However, I believe that they have much further ramifications for sentencing of defendants.
And I don't understand what relief is appropriate here. You say the district court shouldn't have entered this sentencing memorandum after the appeal was filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose we reach out our finger, point at the sentencing memorandum, and zap it, and it turns into dust. It just goes away. We say it's as if it never happened.
Right.
What good does that do you?
Well, if it's in fact zapped and it never happened, it does me no good. Essentially, it has ceased to exist.
The basic problem is that it's even worse than that. I do not see how events that post-date the notice of appeal can possibly provide any relief in the case. Right? A notice of appeal brings up the order the court has entered. And if a district judge does something after the notice of appeal that he lacks authority to do, we will say, tisk, tisk, shouldn't have done it, go away. But the only thing that's before us for review is the things that predate the notice of appeal, and you don't appear to be appealing from anything that predated the notice of appeal.
Well, except for the fact that it is based on a record that's in this court, which includes, at this point, because it has not been stricken by this court, the sentencing memorandum. And from that, we know that the court made findings outside of the defendant's presence.
Who cares, right?
The defendant cares, Your Honor.
No. Look, the only thing that's presented to us is the judgment, the thing that predated the notice of appeal. I could understand an argument that says something like, the judgment was not supported by adequate findings and is therefore defective. Findings that were essential to support the judgment were entered only later. And then I could see how you could get relief. But I don't understand your brief to be saying that.
In this case, those kind of judgments were not made, which is why I prefaced it by saying this is a unique case that has broader implications. Because in this case, the findings that were made later, while impacting Mr. Burton very personally, did not necessarily render the sentence invalid.
Well, is it your argument that if we just look at what the district court said before the judgment was entered and before the appeal was entered, that the judgment is reversible error, that there was some problem, that the findings are inadequate?
If you just look at that, no. That is not my argument. My argument is that
then I don't see that there's anything before us.
Well, unfortunately, what is before you is the sentencing memorandum. And it is still before us.
Things that post-date the notice of appeal are not before us. If you wanted, right, we could say the district court didn't have the authority to enter it and zap, and it's gone. But that doesn't affect the judgment, and we tend not to issue advisory opinions.
Correct.
If you had filed a notice of appeal after the sentencing memorandum, maybe there would be something to appeal from. But you can't appeal on day one and ask the Court of Appeals to do something that happened later. You need to file another notice of appeal. But you need to do something. Your client doesn't benefit unless we vacate the sentence.
Right, which is why the second argument is.
Well, I give up.
Is that he wasn't. I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and frankly, I've struggled with that question when briefing this issue, is that there should be some remedy for a defendant if it is found out that the judge was, in fact, considering things that the judge did not say at sentencing, because the defendant has a right to be present for sentencing and to hear.
You surely don't mean that. Suppose the judge gives a sentence, and you then subpoena the judge's law clerks. Are you entitled to ask the judge's law clerks, did the judge say anything to you about sentencing that he didn't say in open court? If he did, it violated the defendant's right to be present?
No, I'm certainly not saying that. And
so
I know.
We don't have a rule that the judge's thoughts or expressions and so on are censored.
No, they're not censored. They need to be entered contemporaneously, and when they are entered, and the judge puts them on the record.
I'll give up after this. But the rule that something has to be entered contemporaneously is enforced by the doctrine that we look only at what the judge said before he made the sentence. We look at what he said in open court. We look at a sentencing memorandum that he filed at the time of open court and before the judgment. And if that wasn't enough to support the sentence, then we vacate and remand for another sentencing proceeding. But if what the judge said at the time was sufficient to support the sentence, then there's no appealable error.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I believe that because we know, because the judge put it on the record, that becomes an issue in this case, and Mr. Burton has been effectively sentenced outside of his presence. I think the additional problem stems from the government's argument that what the judge did was okay in this case, that the judge could make further findings to aid in the appeal. And certainly, this court cannot allow that to happen. And
well,
it doesn't sound...
Can. As you know, the First Circuit and the Fifth Circuit have said that district judges possess this authority. Now, whether we should look at what the judge said in determining whether the sentence is proper is an interesting question, but it would be raised only if you said, which you're not saying, that what the judge said before imposing sentence was not sufficient.
And I, you know,
or you're almost saying it's not truthful or something, although you see a bigger distance between this later memorandum, whatever it is, and what was said in court at the sentencing than the government sees. They're
correct.
Arguing it's really just a clerical correction. The lawyer for the government made many of the points that the judge picks up in the later memorandum. But I suppose if the judge, if you could show somehow the judge was flat out lying, but I don't see on this record anything close to that.
I'm certainly not saying the judge was lying. It is curious why the memorandum was entered at the time it was. Mr. Burton had filed several documents indicating he was going to appeal many issues, including his sentence. And if it was entered, in fact, to respond to a worry on the judge's part that she had not made sufficient findings at the sentencing hearing, that is a problem. That is a problem that could happen in many cases and more seriously. If there were perhaps a sentencing calculation error and the judge then changed it afterwards.
But by the way, do you think the defendant has a right to be present when we release our opinion in this case?
No, but the federal rules don't cover that. The federal rules do grant him the right to be present for sentencing, for the imposition of judgment. A defendant doesn't have the right to be present here during these oral arguments. So,
does that include when the judge executes that judgment and commitment form? Does the defendant have the right to be present when that is signed?
I don't believe so. It certainly has never been in practice that way, Your Honor. And the moment that's signed is not necessarily when the sentence is imposed. The sentence is imposed in court in front of the defendant. For jurisdictional reasons, the judgment has significance. It also has significance in the Bureau of Prisons, which is a collateral effect of this judgment. It's unclear, certainly it's not in the record, and it's unclear to me whether the Bureau of Prisons had the judge's actual statement of reasons, which actually I did not have until I found out from the government that it had been filed, because we are not routinely given those, or it does have the memorandum and has used that in classifying Mr. Burton. And I see I'm in my rebuttal time. I'll reserve the rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Mr. Histed.
May it please the Court. My name is Cliff Heiston. I represent the United States in this case. Your Honors have gotten right to the heart of this matter, and with respect to that, the government would just simply state that if it's the case that nothing that happened after the notice of appeal is properly before this Court, and we suspect that that is, in fact, the case, and if it's true, as the appellant has conceded, that there was no error in the sentence itself or at the sentencing hearing or in the judgment, then respectfully, there is nothing properly to do except to affirm the judgment of the district court in this case. And
maybe we should strike this sentencing memorandum from the record since it doesn't belong in the record on appeal.
You could strike that, Your Honor.
And
but
tell
we,
the BOP it's not, it doesn't exist.
That's correct, Your Honor. I'm not sure whether that was actually appended to the judgment and commitment order, the memo. Certainly the document called Statement of Reasons would be. But even if you were to strike that sentencing memorandum and zap it, as Judge Easterbrook said, from existence, there would still be nothing left to do. There's no claim of error with respect to the sentence itself.
This defendant was probably already at the BOP before that memo was issued.
It's possible, Your Honor. Yeah.
What was the purpose of the memo?
I can't speak for the actions of the district court. Certainly it could have and perhaps should have been filed more timely. Perhaps a better practice would be to issue a sentencing memorandum in the detail that this one was issued, you know, closer in time to the judgment order or perhaps simultaneously with the judgment order.
Or just put it on the record, you know, at the time of sentencing. The judge does say a few things about the first couple of points at sentencing, and then it's the 3553A factors that she decides to elaborate on later.
That's correct, Your Honor. The government sees the sentencing memorandum as nothing more than an elaboration. There were no new findings of fact.
She hadn't even mentioned quite a few of those factors. They aren't inconsistent with anything she did. They aren't inconsistent with what counsel for the government was saying. But counsel for the government, the last I checked, is not the judge.
Quite so. Unless there are any further questions, we would just ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court and not remand this matter for sentencing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Christensen?
If we're talking about zapping the sentencing memorandum and letting the BOP know about, the Bureau of Prisons know about that, I will say from my experience in these cases, the BOP doesn't care, and I hate to say it to this court, about the Court of Appeals orders. They will only recognize amended judgments from the district court. And that is part of my concern why this should go back for an amended judgment rather than just simply striking it, because simply striking the memorandum.
There's nothing wrong with the judgment. That's...
Well, the judgment now, however, includes this memorandum that's been sent.
No, the judgment does not. The judgment includes the judgment. The only judgment in a criminal case is the sentence.
Correct.
There's about an 8-page long judgment in this case, and that's it.
However, in practice, probation sends any findings made about sentencing to the BOP. So it may not, in fact, be formally attached.
Look, we do not review other documents in criminal cases. We don't review the pre-sentence report. We don't review, right? You get the idea. There are lots of documents that go to the Bureau of Prisons. The indictment goes. The pre-sentence report goes. They are not reviewable in the Court of Appeals. The only thing that's reviewable is the judgment.
Correct. So that was my only point. So unless there are further questions from the court, I ask that, of course, it be stricken and also be remanded.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.